The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello there. This is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now it's time to return one last time to the July 2022 edition of Our State magazine, whose theme this month has been Green Acres. But this being the last reading of the month, you know what that means if you're loyal listeners. This is when I read the Decades article. We're up to the 1980s, the decade of local heroes. And today's article is entitled The Challenger 7. And I'll bet you all know what that means, because like the shooting of JFK, I think everybody remembers where they were when the Challenger exploded. I certainly do. And so, it says here, one of the worst accidents of the American space program shapes a generation. In 1986, the nation mourns the heroes aboard the space shuttle Challenger, including two astronauts with deep ties to North Carolina, written, as always, by Philip Girard. Nice picture here of the takeoff. The caption says, on January 28, 1986, Challenger ascended with seven aboard. Ellison Onizuka, Christina McAuliffe, Greg Jarvis, Judith Resnick, Ron McNair, Dick Scobie, and Michael Smith. This is a very interesting picture. The Challenger is just leaving the platform with a tremendous blast of white steam and smoke coming down, and it's billowed, hits at the ground, it is billowed everywhere. But silhouetted here are hundreds of birds that were nesting next to the river, and with the noise of the Challenger, they all got up and flew off. So we see them against a dark blue sky, not a cloud in that sky, and this tremendous amount of steam and smoke that is generated by the jet engines as it leaves its platform. Captain Michael J. Smith and Dr. Ronald Irwin McNair have been selected to be a part of what one journalist will later call the perfect crew. Six highly skilled astronauts and a high school social studies teacher from Concord, as it's pronounced there, New Hampshire, the first teacher in space. They've trained together for months, and on that cold morning of January 28, 1986, they board the space shuttle Challenger at the Kennedy Space Center in Merritt Island, Florida, preparing for an early morning launch. Smith spent his boyhood on a chicken farm in Beaufort, across the road from the Beaufort-Moorhead City Airport, an old World War II-era airfield. Entranced by the sight of airplanes taking off and landing, he took flying lessons and soloed by the time he was 16, before he even passed his driver's license test. A three-letter man at East Carteret High School, he was voted most outstanding student. He won an appointment to the United States Naval Academy, where he earned a degree in naval science and subsequently completed a master's degree in aeronautical engineering at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, in 1968. But a flyer at heart, he naturally followed up his academic studies with rigorous training as a naval aviator in Pensacola, Florida. He was then posted to Kingsville, Texas, for Advanced Jet Training Command, and later flew A-6 intruders. in 3 carrier deployments and stints as a test pilot and flight instructor. Smith logged nearly 5,000 hours of flight time in 28 different aircraft, an astonishing range of flight experience. In 1980, NASA selects him for its astronaut training program. A year later, he is officially qualified to pilot a space shuttle. Ronald E. McNair came to North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University in 1967 from Carver High School in racially segregated Lake City, South Carolina, where he served as class valedictorian. He was determined to earn a doctorate within 10 years of graduation. At A&T, he graduated magna cum laude with a B.S. in physics, then earned a Ph.D. in laser physics from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology at the age of 26, fulfilling his high school promise to himself. McNair becomes preeminent in the field of laser physics, earning one prestigious distinction after another. Presidential Scholar, Ford Foundation Fellow, and NATO Fellow, along with 3 honorary doctorates and a host of other awards. In 1978, he was selected for NASA's astronaut training program. And in 1984, he becomes just the 2nd black astronaut in space, flying as mission specialist aboard Challenger. Among other duties, McNair operates the Cinema 360 motion picture camera and is photographed aboard the shuttle wearing a dark blue beret and grinning behind aviator sunglasses, holding a movie clapboard and wearing a name badge reading Cecil B. McNair. Harking back to his jazz band days in college, he's also pictured playing his saxophone on board Challenger. He logs 191 hours in orbit. Now, Smith and McNair are set to fly together on Challenger. Smith as pilot and McNair once again as mission specialist. The shuttle commander is Lieutenant Colonel Francis R. Dick Scobie. Other mission specialists are Lieutenant Colonel Ellison S. Onizuka and Dr. Judith A. Resnick. Payload specialists are Gregory B. Jarvis and the teacher S. Krista McAuliffe, whose students back in New Hampshire will be watching the launch live on television. The mission is meant to last 7 days, during which time the crew is tasked with deploying and retrieving the Spartan satellite to monitor Halley's Comet, conduct experiments in fluid dynamics, and broadcast McAuliffe's lessons from space. This Challenger mission, the 10th for the workhorse craft, is originally scheduled for liftoff on January 22nd, but delays caused by the previous mission pushed back the launch until January 23rd, then January 24th. The space shuttle requires an available transoceanic abort landing, TAL site, in case the aircraft must cut short its mission. On January 24th, bad weather closes in on Dakar, Senegal, Challenger's TAL. NASA controllers move the TAL to Casablanca, Morocco, and plan a January 25th countdown. But the launch team can't meet the new date. The weather forecast indicates the 26th won't provide a safe launch window. As it turns out, the weather remains fine for launch, but the opportunity has passed. Launch director Gene Thomas says later, "Sunday morning, the weather was perfect. We got a bad report. It happens." Thus, on Monday, January 27th, the team at Kennedy prepares to launch Challenger. But there's another glitch. With the crew on board, the closeout team locks the hatch behind them with a special tool, but can't extricate the tool from the lock. They saw away the tool and drill out the hatch bolt, but by then, strong crosswinds have developed. The flight is scrubbed again. Over the past few weeks, the weather has been predictably mild, with daytime highs in the mid-50s. But overnight, a fast-moving front of Arctic air slaps into the southeast. Cape Canaveral, like other nearby communities, experiences the coldest morning on record for that date. On the launch pad, water pipes are drained or left open to prevent freezing. And during the nighttime hours, their leakage forms into thick ridges of icicles that can pose a debris hazard during launch. So the early morning liftoff is pushed back to allow time for sunshine to melt the ice. At launch time, 11:38 Eastern Standard Time, NASA measures the air temperature at ground level as 36 degrees Fahrenheit. But the temperature at a critical solid roost rocket booster joint on the giant fuselage measures an estimated 28 degrees, well below freezing. And only later will investigators determine that the joints between sections of the rocket are likely as much as 20 degrees cooler on the shaded side of the fuselage than on the sun-warmed face. The fuel segments of the solid rocket boosters are sealed from leaking hot gases by flexible O-rings, large gaskets meant to contain the ignited fuel. Shortly after launch, Daniel Zwirling and Howard Berkes of National Public Radio meet with engineers at Morton Thiokol, Incorporated, the Utah-based contractor that fabricated the solid rocket boosters and their O-rings, who insist on anonymity to avoid retaliation, and learn a disturbing story. The engineers had resisted the launch, had recommended against it, citing the blow-by in an earlier low-temperature launch and studies of the elasticity of the O-rings, Berkes reports. The night before liftoff, these two Thiokol engineers, along with several colleagues, tried to convince NASA to postpone liftoff. But there's a lot riding on this mission. The Teacher in Space initiative, regarded by some at NASA as a publicity stunt, is designed to gin up flagging public support for the agency, whose missions, lacking the glamour of the moonshots, even the name Space Shuttle conjures an image of a long, uneventful commute rather than an adventure in the cosmos. NASA has never lost an astronaut in a space mission. And President Ronald Reagan, whose State of the Union address is scheduled for the evening of the eventual launch day, plans to celebrate Challenger's achievement. The managers of Thiokol eventually overrule the engineers and give the go-ahead for launch. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to the seven members of the perfect crew aboard Challenger, during the countdown, one of the engineers silently prays that the seals will hold. Challenger launches into a translucent blue sky that hides clear air turbulence, two shearing jet streaks buffeting the craft from different directions, increasing whatever strain was already caused by the extreme temperature. At about 1 minute and 4 seconds into the flight, a plume of fiery gases streams from the right booster. 9 seconds later, at 46,000 feet, the space shuttle breaks up in a brilliant flash, shooting the cabin crew to its apogee of 65,000 feet and then into the sea at more than 200 miles an hour, a descent that lasts 2 minutes and 45 seconds. When the cabin wreckage is recovered, investigators salvage three air packs that were activated after the catastrophic breakup, including Smith's, indicating that at least some of the crew may have survived until crashing into the sea. The last recorded words from the flight deck are Smith's. Uh-oh, 3/8. Reagan appoints a presidential commission, headed by William Rogers, the former Secretary of State. His opening statement does not reassure commission member Richard Feynman, a Nobel laureate in physics. We are not going to conduct this investigation in a manner which would be unfairly critical of NASA, Rogers admonishes the group, which includes astronaut Sally Ride, who once flew on Challenger. Ride, not so compliant, shares temperature data on the O-rings with Air Force General Donald Cutnia, who briefs Feynman. During a televised hearing, Feynman extracts the O-ring from a scale model of Challenger. He dunks it into a glass of ice water and then crimps it. And I discovered that when you put some pressure on it for a while and then undo it, it maintains. It doesn't stretch back. The O-ring fails. Thus, on that bright, fatal morning, Smith, McNair, and their fellow members of the perfect crew aboard Challenger launched into eternity. Coming in August, Wilmington builds a reputation as Hollywood East. And now, Queen of the Pawpaws, native to all 100 counties in North Carolina, this odd fruit had been all but forgotten. A farmer in Watauga County intends to change that. Written by Lee Ann Henyon. It's not yet noon, and Susan Owen is already on her front porch singing about pawpaws, North America's largest edible fruit. And she's dancing, swooping her arms low as if she's harvesting an invisible bounty. The folk song she's belting is one that her mother taught her. Where, oh, where is pretty little Susie? Way down yonder in the pawpaw patch, picking up pawpaws, putting them in her basket. As she pantomimes the lyrics, Owen is careful not to bump into the treasures that crowd the porch of her log cabin, remnants of her blacksmith work, an antique sewing machine, just-picked heirloom peppers of the variety she's chosen to grow because of their heart shape. The cabin itself belongs in an antiques collection. It's a roughly 200-year-old building that she's moved from the other side of Watauga County when development threatened. Owen is like some sort of mountain home Midas. Everything she touches turns to art. On this particular morning, she's serenading the mountains around Villis, just shy of the Tennessee line. Back when Owen learned the tune she's singing, she'd never even seen a pawpaw. Every time we sang it, she recalls, I'd say, Mama, what's a pawpaw? And she'd say, I don't really know. Back then, we didn't have Google, so we never did find out. Years passed. Owen grew up in Winston-Salem, but she dreamed of living in Appalachia. When she was a teenager, she wrote an essay explaining where she saw herself later in life, and she remembers a college counselor telling her, you can't live in a cabin on a farm in the mountains. You need to be a CEO or something. I didn't come from farming stock, Owen says. People thought that essay was a pipe dream. She went on to study art education in college, but after graduation, she dedicated decades to tending medicinal herbs, flowers, and bees on 42 acres of Appalachian holler and slope that she named the Lily Patch Farm. In the late 1990s, she attended an event where she met a man selling pencil-sized saplings labeled as pawpaws. Given her childhood association with the old folk song, it was like meeting someone peddling magic beans. Are those really pawpaws? Owen asked. The man assured her that they were, and he advised her she'd need to take at least two to ensure cross-pollination. She left with three. For a long time, after she planted those saplings on a hillside next to her cabin, Owen didn't think much about them. Pawpaw trees can take up to 8 years to start bearing fruit. When that eventually happened, her curiosity was piqued. We have Google now, Owen says. So I started reading about pawpaws. And once she started, she couldn't stop. She discovered that Thomas Jefferson grew them. John James Audubon drew them. And they were rumored to have been George Washington's favorite dessert. Pawpaws are native to most of the eastern United States and parts of Canada, and they have historically been beloved in Appalachia. Yet, between the time the traditional folk song was written and when Owen learned it, the fruit had fallen out of favor. Pawpaws are, in many ways, a challenging crop for a farmer to champion. They're difficult to transport. They need to ripen on the tree. Pawpaws don't translate into an industrial agricultural model, and that's part of why local pawpaw patches were neglected as produce was increasingly bulk-grown and shipped. But Owen, now CEO of her own farm, headquartered in her mountain cabin, has a soft spot for outliers and improbable paths. All it takes for me to accomplish something, she says, is to have someone tell me that it cannot be done. Around the time that Owen planted her first sapling, pawpaws were experiencing their own creative renaissance, with related festivals popping up along the East Coast. Belong then, she'd attended a string of them. She subsequently secured grants to research pawpaws, traveling to places like Kentucky State University, which claims the only full-time pawpaw research plant or program on Earth. Ultimately, she worked her way onto stages, as a speaker, sharing her enthusiasm with attendees from as far away as Germany and Korea. It was at one of those events that Owen found herself surrounded by a group of men pontificating on the value of cultivars. Pawpaws bred for size and other attributes such as taste over natives. "I know y'all are about bigger and better," she told them, "but there's something to be said for native plants." Still, she was intrigued by the different flavor profiles of the cultivars. One of the men in particular, Neil Peterson, caught her attention. Peterson, whose trademark cultivars are legendary, has only granted licenses to a handful of nurseries in the country, allowing them to sell his varieties. After some cajoling, Owen's farm is now one of them. In recent years, she has found success as a pawpaw cheerleader, particularly in the High County. Like many enthusiasts, she thought that freezing pawpaw pulp might be a way to share them with a wider audience. Now, with Owen's fruit, Appalachian Mountain Brewery makes pawpaw beer. The aptly named Over Yonder restaurant in Valley Crucis has whipped up pawpaw pudding, and Boone's Lost Province Brewing Company uses the fruit for sorbet. Each of these culinary creations began on the Lily Patch farm and ended with explosions of flavor on the tongues of people, some of whom, like Owen, had been singing about pawpaws all their lives without ever having tasted one. Owen walks over to the hillside where her original native trees are growing. When she reaches into the shade of the branches, fruit falls into her hand. She loves pawpaw ice cream. Pawpaw cheesecake might be her favorite baked good, but there's nothing that she loves more than a fresh pawpaw straight from the tree. When it comes to snacking, she says natives are the perfect size. She scores the skin with the edge of her fingernail, revealing a soft interior the color of heavy cream. She gently squeezes, and the fruit comes out of the halved skin like a push-up pup. The pawpaw's giant seeds are as slick as the interior of a muscadine skin, and, thinking ahead to future planting seasons, she keeps every one of them. Owen describes the flavor of pawpaws as a hybrid of pineapple, banana, and mango, but adds, "To me, a pawpaw tastes like a pawpaw. It has the consistency of custard and a hint of something tropical, or rather temperate, like a temperate rainforest of Appalachia. These trees were around in the Pliocene when mastodons were roaming," she says. "Even their pollination process seems a relic. It is not carried out by bees or butterflies. It's dependent on flies and beetles. The way I see it, farming is about paying attention to details, and details delight me," Owen says. "I'm always on the lookout for itty-bitty bugs." Not long ago, she was standing in this very spot when she spotted a flash of black and white. It was a zebra swallowtail butterfly. Just as monarchs lay their eggs on milkweed, zebra swallowtails are dependent on pawpaw leaves. "I was so excited to see that butterfly. I didn't know what to do with myself," she says. "Finally, I ran inside to get my camera. By the time I got back, he was gone." The beauty of zebra swallowtails, like the pawpaw's harvest season, which lasts only a few weeks each year, is fleeting. "I don't have a photo to prove it," she says, "but I'm telling you, there are zebras living here, all because of the pawpaw trees." Owens opens the screen door of her cabin and grabs a hat from the deer antlers that act as her coat rack. Then she starts walking down yonder into a holler, past outbuildings and garden beds. The gravel road has switchbacks, but Owen doesn't slow for curves. She walks through a small forested area, and the canopy opens to reveal her main pawpaw orchard. Many of the trees are less than half the size of her original plantings, though they are old enough to fruit. "Aren't they cute?" she exclaims, joyfully clapping her hands at the sight of them. The trees, cultivars, are planted in rows. She started with 30, now she has 60, and will eventually add 100 or more. But first, there's fruit to process. What's not sold fresh will be frozen as pulp for distribution. She nods toward a tree that's lost one of its pawpaws to gravity. It's a cultivar, large as a baked potato. "Pawpaws bruise easily," she says. "I try to get to them before they go down, but it's not always possible. Still, the fruit isn't too far gone to be edible." Owens bends to lift the fallen fruit in a motion that mirrors the dance that she's practiced for half a century. Little Susie, born of the beloved folk song, might not have known better than to put ripe pawpaws in her pocket, but grown up, Owen knows that that would make a mess of laundry. Even if she wanted to store that pawpaw in her trousers, there wouldn't be room. Because back when she was snacking on native fruit, she needed a place to store its next generation bounty. So her pockets are already full of pawpaw seeds. Well, we have just a few minutes left, so let's see what's going on in Hendersonville. This western North Carolina city offers fine dining, shops, and galleries, plus a vibrant history in a cozy mountain setting, written by Katie King. Picture here, Henderson's tree-lined Main Street is just minutes away from hiking, mountain biking, kayaking, and more. In the Blue Ridge Mountains. When the Skyland Hotel opened in Hendersonville in 1929, it became a landmark for visitors. The stately six-story building at the corner of Main Street and 6th Avenue signaled, and still does, that they had arrived downtown. It was there that local tour guide Mary Jo Paget's parents, who lived in Rutherford County, spent their honeymoon years before Paget would move to Hendersonville from Atlanta. Since 2014, Paget has led history walks, including one that stops at the Skyland Hotel, which was converted to private residences in the early 1970s, through downtown's picturesque streetscapes, past trendy restaurants and breweries and quaint boutiques filled with local art and other intriguing wares, in tours covering Main Street, the 7th Avenue, Depot District, Oakdale Cemetery, and murals, mosaics, and ghost signs. Paget reveals the history and the architecture of the town that she's called home for more than 40 years. "I'm a person who likes to know the history of the place where I'm living," she says. "I thought if that was of interest to me, then it would be of interest to others. Like me, they're always happy to end of the tour by the end of the tour to say, 'Wow, I feel so much more grounded, so much more in love with where I live now because I've learned something about the past.'" Very little time to talk about shopping and stuff like that, but there's Woodlands Galley, which is furniture, clothing, jewelry, bath and body products. Then we have Wag, a unique pet boutique. Since 2010, this boutique has been a favorite of pet owners, especially those who like to show off and have their pets wear really cute things, Paget says. Then there's Dish Girl. Kay Speranza's small but vibrant shop on 6th Avenue has a great display of Fiesta ware. Some of it's vintage, some of it new. It's a really fun place, Paget says. And then there's Narnia Studios. Barbara Hughes' whimsical florist shop and gift boutique is a wonderland of American-made products, including local art, home and garden decor, jewelry, and bath products. You can't miss the clawfoot bathtub filled with colorful soap rocks. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.